You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-all-fits branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear, all backed by above-and-beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters has been a branded apparel supplier to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code pod20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20, code pod20, for 20% off your first product.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the big stories making the news here in Ireland and around the world. And coming up on today's show, two of the world's most powerful men are making headlines in the US election. Last week, Elon Musk's ex, and now this week, Jeff Bezos and his Washington Post announced they won't endorse either candidate. The decision by one of America's most iconic newspapers has sparked backlash from both current and former staff, including Bob Woodworth and Card Bernstein, who, of course, exposed the Watergate scandal back in 1972. Later, David Folkenflik from the NPR News Service will join us to explain why this moment matters so much. And turning back home, the heat is on for the upcoming Irish election. It's expected that the Taoiseach will dissolve the Dáil next week and call it officially. Political Democratic strategist Jane Carville once said, "It's the economy, stupid." And if that's true, the government should be on solid ground. But is it all that simple? Dan O'Brien, economist, and Linda Daly from the Sunday Times will help us to break down the numbers. And finally, have you found your tribe yet? Sometimes you think of tribes in a very negative light, but a new book is showing how tapping into our tribal instincts can actually help us to work better together. The author's going to be here later to explain how finding our tribe can foster collaboration in the workplace and beyond. You can contact us, as always, on takingstock@newstalk.com, or I'm open on X at StockNT. Now, for our first item this week, we're going to start here at home. And obviously, the Dáil is coming back next week, and there's a massive amount of speculation that Simon Harris, on Taoiseach Simon Harris, will call the election. But how do you run an election campaign if people feel that the economy is absolutely booming? That's the conundrum that's facing the government and indeed the opposition in the next few weeks ahead. What can they promise? And will the electorate actually respond positively to those promises, or will they just see it all as electioneering? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Linda Daly. He's a business reporter for the Sunday Times Ireland, and she's been writing about this very issue of late. And I'm also joined by Dan O'Brien from the Institute for International and European Affairs for his take on the matter. You're both very welcome. And Dan, I'm going to start with you if I can, please, because, you know, there is this just general feeling that the economy is booming at the moment. Maybe you could start us off in that context and just put some frame around that, just how strong the economy is going into this general election. And has there been a period of time that you as an economist could look back at and say, yeah, look, like for like, this is, you know, this is very similar?
Well, that's a great question, Mandy, and thanks for having me. I think the economy is growing very strongly, and nearly every indicator shows that. I don't think people are getting better off as fast as, let's say, the early 2000s, when the Celtic Tiger was really roaring. Number of reasons for that, inflation being one of the most important in recent years, that's eaten into wages. So that's meant that people haven't been feeling, and are quite right in that, haven't been getting better off. So most indicators say the economy is doing really well, but perhaps we've had better times in the past, but we certainly have had much worse times. Mm. So compared to, say, Britain, where we've recently had a government thrown out, they had a very weak economy. So the economy is really important, particularly when the economy isn't doing well. People want that to change. But if we look to the United States, for example, the economy is doing really well, but perceptions about the economy differ depending on which party you're in, even though they're all living in the same economy. So I think Ireland is maybe a little bit more like the United States. It's more unpredictable how things will go. I think it's even a lot more unpredictable than the United States. There are a lot of factors in play, and certainly we saw at the last general election in 2020, the campaign radically changed things, and the outcome was nobody expected. So we live in much more volatile times, and times that even as an economist, I would say the economy matters less than it used to.
Mm. And what's your sense of this age-old question, whether buying people's votes actually works in Ireland. You know, we're a very sophisticated electorate, I think, because, you know, the vast majority of people are well educated. We've just had a massive, massive budget. Do you think we're particularly sceptical when it comes to an election period and our votes being bought?
Well, political scientists say that people are most influenced by giveaways when they have felt them immediately. They're not promised in the future and they haven't come in the past and they're real. So something like a universal benefit, like double children's allowance, child benefit, which a lot of people will benefit from, you know, we're going to be voting either before or after one of those double benefits or after both of them have been given out. So I think people will feel that, and I think people will be influenced to some extent by that. But on the other hand, when the economy is doing well, people are going to say, well, could the other side, if we change government, could they give me even more? So again, I think this is a really unpredictable election that we're facing into. I certainly wouldn't, I'm not a betting man, but even if I was, I wouldn't be putting any money on the outcome. So I think it's very unclear, and we could have lots of things happening during the campaign that nobody's predicted, and it could go in different ways.
Yeah, and Linda, I'm going to bring you in here if I can. Against that backdrop of huge economic success that the government can rightly point to and say that they've had a handle on this, there's also a number of key areas that is linked to the economy that they will struggle with. You and your colleague John Isle have been looking at that issue of late. Maybe take us through those 5 points that you made about the other issues that are in the economy but marginal to it in some respects.
Yeah, so we did an article on Sunday just looking at if the economy was the key kind of reason why people were going to vote in the upcoming election, what would the areas be and how had the government done? So we looked at employment, housing, cost of living, cost of doing business and the public finances. So at the moment, public finances are great. We're on course to get 30 million in tax receipts this year. Or 30 billion, is it? And with employment, obviously the headline figures, it's a slam dunk for the government on appearance. You know, we're 4.3% unemployment rate. It's really up to the top in the European stats, and it looks great. Cost of living, obviously, is not so good. If you look at the cost of living and how people have felt, you know, they feel that inflation has risen. Wages haven't kept up with inflation, rather. And if you look, but obviously this year, though, inflation and wages are kind of getting more in line. Mm. Whether people feel that in time for the election is another thing. And cost of business is a big, huge issue. Obviously, the government has come in for a lot of flack because businesses are blaming it for not reducing the VAT rate, hospitality businesses, that is. And then if you look at the cost of the employment wages, you know, businesses are feeling the pressure on that. I think where the government will really suffer and will struggle to win the vote is around housing. And I suppose there's a wide open goal for the opposition there coming up to the end of the year, because it looks like the government will miss its targets of 40,000 new homes built. Then on Friday, there was a figure of 15,000 people homeless. Now, a lot of those are immigrants. So, you know, well, it was around 10,000 previously. Obviously, we have the immigration issue. So there's some issues there for the government where they'll struggle to win the vote.
Right. So 5 main headlines there. We've got the employment issue, the housing issue, the cost of living, the cost of business and the public finances. And the public finances in rude health, as Dan has outlined for us. But Dan, I've heard you on a number of programmes now saying, like, look, we're not headed for a recession. There's not that there's nothing to worry about. Of course, we've got the issue of corporation tax. But what do you see as the biggest threat to the public finances in a macro sense?
Threat to my mind is actually what happens in the US election. If one of the candidates is elected and that candidate has promised to put a tax on every single thing that comes into the United States, that's imported into the United States, we are massive exporters to the United States. We export more stuff, ship more stuff across the Atlantic than France, a G7, a big G7 economy. Now, if those tariffs, those taxes on imports come in, to my mind, that is the biggest near-term foreseeable risk to the Irish economy that could really shake up our economy. Other than that, you know, we're in no bubble. I can see no evidence of of a bubble in the economy. We are losing competitiveness in some ways, but that doesn't lead to a crash. That leads to a gradual phasing out of growth. So I think that's the sort of scenario that we're looking at over the coming years, potentially, if we don't address some of those capacity problems that we have. But in, as I say, the short term, it's Trump tariffs in the short term. Over the long term, a gradual loss of competitiveness would be the two things that I worry about.
And that's the negative side of the US election. And if Trump got in, but if Harris got in, are there policies that she has that maybe could help us?
Well, some of the policies she has, such as raising corporation tax further, you know, the Democrat Party in some ways has moved considerably towards the left in economic policies, certainly is no longer an open free trading partner. Now, she hasn't committed to doing anything like Trump in terms of lowering international trade. But at the same time, the Democratic Party has become sort of less pro-business, or even some would say more hostile to business. And that could in some ways benefit Ireland if companies decide to move more of their operations out of the United States and locate them abroad and locate them here. So there could actually be an upside in having a president that's, you know, as I say, not so pro-business, that businesses decide with their feet what to do and move more of their operations abroad. So potential upside from that.
Linda, I want to bring you back in here now. One of the other issues that you mentioned was employment. And on the face of it, really good news story again here for the government in that we're at full employment. But also IFAC out this week saying that we need potentially 80,000 more workers into the workforce if we're going to deal with the capacity constraints that we have. So how or what can the government or opposition do to physically, you know, inject and put more people into the workforce?
Yeah, so I suppose Tom McDonnell, co-director of the Nevin Economic Research Institute, in the interview that we did for the piece, he pointed out that dealing with childcare and sorting out the childcare infrastructure will get more people like lone parents back into the workforce. So we may be near capacity, but lone parents, travellers, there are certain cohorts that don't participate as much as maybe other people do. So his take is that if you kind of create a state-run childcare similar to schools, that more people then will be able to work. Now, a couple of the parties are looking at this. The old Sinn Féin, for example, is proposing €10 a day childcare. The Social Democrats have gone further and said that they would start initiating the process, and I'm sure it would take a long time, of a public model childcare. So things like that, also obviously apprenticeship schemes when it comes to construction. I mean, that is one of the big things. I mean, there's just not enough apprentices being brought in, and that's a hangover from the recession. Because the contractors just didn't take apprentices on. So you just need to, with that, we're a really highly educated economy now and a society at this stage, but there are certain pockets that just don't do as well as others.
Dan, the housing issue. Now, to save us all from playing that horrible game of housing statistics bingo, we will just agree that there is a real shortage of supply. There is a huge demand. There's still desperate constraints around bureaucracy and building. There's the issues around the supply of credit to builders and all of the planning issues that we deal with. What, Dan, would you like to see in a manifesto that would at least attempt to address the concerns that IFAC, the central bank, and nearly every multinational who comes here, not to mind the thousands of people, you know, with their children still living in the box room, would like to see that actually might just unlock something significant in the housing market?
Look, Mandy, I don't think anything's going to unlock anything significant. We're now building around the average number of houses per population as most other countries. Difference is our population is growing much faster, and the difference is that's making our economy grow much faster. So this brings us to a conundrum. Do we want to slow down immigration, which is a massive driver of employment growth, and then more people are employed who come here, then also need housing? So you have this trade-off here between bringing more people in to keep the economy growing at a more rapid rate, but that putting more pressure on housing Okay, so there's a balance to be struck here, in terms of, you know, do we want to try and alleviate demand pressure for housing, because we're simply not going to be able to meet that even in the short to medium term.
When you say demand, do you mean purchase demand toward rental, or how could you ease demand?
Both. Okay. So both people who come to live in a country for the first few years at least, will rent. It's very unusual for somebody for coming from abroad to go to a country and buy a house, you know, immediately. Most rent. So the inward migration puts more pressure on the rental sector than the housing, than the purchasing sector, but it affects both parts of the market. So when you have a rapidly rising population, and now most of our population growth is coming from immigration, that's having an effect on the housing side. So there is a balance here, and I've been slightly surprised in Ireland that we haven't got into talking about that. I know there's an issue of not wanting to look at any negative side of immigration, but immigration is a complex social phenomenon. And, you know, if we want to grow the economy by having more people in, we're going to have bigger housing problems, because you're simply not going to grow the housing supply at the rate that we've had people coming into the country in recent years. So it's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. It's one of the upsides of success that you're growing so strongly. Lots of people want to come here to live and work, but at the same time, it's adding to the housing demand issue. So that's a conundrum. And I don't think we've really had much of a debate around that yet. Maybe that will come out in the election.
Perhaps. Linda, that's a really valid point, isn't it? That you can't really have a discussion about either the economy or housing or rental housing without actually touching on the issue of immigration. It's such a big political issue. Did that surface in any way in this research?
Yeah. So, I mean, the EU did a survey after the recent local elections. I was actually quite surprised that the economy led the way. So that was the motivating topic for people actually voting, was rising cost of living and the economic situation. Now, migration was there. 28% said that drove them to vote in the elections. I mean, I think in the Irish elections, it will be a huge issue. I mean, especially when you see the rise of the right, really. I suppose on the housing front, you know, I mean, it's worth saying that the state has done a lot in recent years, and somebody once explained to me, said to me, you know, housing is like a big wheel, okay? So it's just taken so long for that wheel to ramp up. Moves are being made, more homes need to be built. So just beware of the parties who are saying, oh, we'll get it fixed in 1 or 2 years, because that's not going to happen.
Yeah,
and especially with the rising number of people who are coming here, you know, we need to fill them in. And it's just mad when you think that 10 years ago, 10 years ago, 2014, when the cranes were going back up, we had this thing called Crane Watch, and everybody, like, you know, people decried the fact that properties were being built and expected us to find ourselves in another crash within a few years.
Well, look,
now we're crying out for cranes.
Absolutely. Look, things have changed, and that's politics for you, and that's the economy. Look, I think this is a fascinating, you know, prism to look at the election through, and I thank you both very much for taking the time to do just that with me today. That was Linda Daly, the business reporter for the Sunday Times Ireland, and also Dan O'Brien from the Institute for International and European Affairs. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, William.
Thanks.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk with me, Mandy Johnston. Coming up, tribal instincts could make for good business. Find out why after this short break. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, what do you think when you hear the words tribe or tribal? And can they be used in a positive way? Well, my next guest has just written a book where he argues tribalism, which we sometimes think of as a dividing force, has the power to bring us together. It's great to welcome Michael Morris, author of Tribal, How the Cultural Instincts That Divide Us Can Help Bring Us Together, to the show. He's joining us now from Columbia University in New York. Michael, you're very welcome to News Talk.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Michael, before we get into the book, you might just tell us a bit about yourself and why you chose to write a book like this about tribalism.
Well, I guess I would like to say it's because I'm at Columbia University, the site of some campus tribalism in the last year, but that would be a fib. I didn't foresee that there would be quite as much tribalism going on in the fall of 2024 as there is. I started writing the book because I'm a cultural psychologist. I'm a behavioral scientist who studies the way that cultural frameworks operate in our brain and in our mind. And I've been teaching at business schools for several decades. And so I've developed a playbook of how leaders and managers and ordinary employees can use what we know about how culture operates in people's minds to have influence, to make changes, to rally collective action. So I really started to write this more as a toolkit. But then while writing it, these conflicts in the world, whether partisan or ethnic or sectarian, have become dominant in the headlines. And there is this way of talking about tribalism, at least in this country, as though some sort of primal hate has been unleashed upon the world that is dooming our democracy and dooming the hope for diverse societies and dooming the hope for international comity. And I think that that is a misunderstanding, a misdiagnosis. It's mostly something that's come from the pundit class. It's not really based on any of the science about what tribal instincts are.
Mm. And that's very, very interesting that you say in that part of the world, tribalism has negative connotations. And in reading some of the preface for the book and stuff, that notion that tribalism is a bad thing. And this is just a very personal opinion on my own behalf. But when I think of tribes and tribal, maybe it's because we're from Ireland. I think it's a very positive word, actually. And I think it's culturally a very strong word. And at least here in Ireland, it's something that is seen in a very positive manner. So maybe we'll start not with culturally where we're at now, but like looking at our own psyche and how deeply seated the idea of tribalism sits within our own psyche.
I should admit that my own family comes from one of the so-called 12 tribes of Galway.
There you go.
Which has a complicated history. I think it's more the reappropriation of an insult, you know, but it is nonetheless a term used, you know, with some affectionate pride, I guess, or some combination.
Yeah, so you'll know what I mean when I say that it has positive connotations here as well, historical. Well,
the tribal instincts, you know, if you talk to an evolutionary anthropologist, are the distinctly human social instincts that enable our distinctly human form of social organization, which is living in very large groups that transcend kith and kin. And those groups work because they're glued together with shared culture. And the tribal instincts are instincts for solidarity. They're instincts for collective action. And I think in Ireland, people feel that, you know, your history, your independence movements have been tribal in many ways. And I think that when you understand what the tribal instincts really are, it doesn't mean that you think there are no conflicts in the world, but it suggests ways of ameliorating them that are not so obvious if you think that the conflicts start from some sort of primal rage or some innate animosity towards outsiders. A species that was wired that way would not be as successful as Homo sapiens. You know, there was a species like that, it's called Neanderthals. You know, it went extinct.
Yeah, now in your book, you do say that, and you mentioned this a couple of times, that we're wired in a particular way. You say that there are three distinct ways in which we're hardwired that evolves into this tribal state for us. Can you just maybe take us through what those three ways are?
Yeah, these are the three major waves of evolution that created three basic systems in our group psychology. And the first one, the peer instincts, is our impulse to imitate those around us. And we can recognize that in the way that we glance at our neighbors and our coworkers and our classmates, and we feel an impulse to be like them and to fit in. And then the second one I call the hero instinct, and that's our upward attention to celebrities and MVPs and VIPs and the sort of cultural heroes, the people with prestige in our community. And we feel an impulse to emulate them, and we want to try to share in the esteem and the tribute that they enjoy. And the final wave, which may sound like the most primitive, but it's the most recently evolved, I call the ancestor instinct. And the ancestor instinct is this deep ache we have to perpetuate traditions, to keep alive the ways of past generations. We can recognize it in ourselves, in the nostalgia that we feel towards the past generations of our country, towards our deep curiosity about the founders of our companies, to our, you know, intense fetishization of antiques. You know, we have this special way of thinking about things that come from the past. We want to preserve them. We want to maintain them.
The one that fascinated me was the second one, the what you call the hero instinct. And this is an ambition within the group to be the most respected. You mentioned celebrity there, but is that something that's always been part of this tribal, the tribal nature, if you like, or tribal psyche, that there'd be an aspiration toward being the best within the tribe, that competitive edge or that competitive ambition?
Yes, I think there's an interesting controversy in anthropology about this topic. Some anthropologists are wedded to the idea that in subsistence groups, hunter-gatherer groups, that it's completely egalitarian. And that's based on things like the sort of bushmen of the Kalahari have this ritual called insulting the meat, where when the hunters come back, when one hunter is successful, instead of fawning all over that hunter, you know, people will say, oh, what is that, a rabbit? You know, when he has killed an antelope. And so they kind of belittle the hunter. And that's what we call a status leveling ritual. And in these groups, there is a tendency to try to reduce the salience of status because everyone has to work together. But, you know, if the hunters genuinely felt insulted, there would be a real incentive problem. You know, hunters would be not trying to come back with any meat. So I think there's an overreading of the significance of that. And in fact, when more biological anthropologists study these groups, they tend to find that the more successful hunters, you know, which they tally quantitatively, end up having more children, you know, end up getting more resources. So there are rewards from the group that come to the contributors, even if the surface discourse is about equality.
Yeah, that's a great example to explain that one. The book is obviously full of examples like this. Maybe you could take us through some of the other issues that you looked at that demonstrate how tribalism is used in a positive sense. I'm thinking of one in particular that I saw, which was the 2002 South Korean soccer team, for example.
Yes. Well, that is an example that, you know, has caused a lot of head scratching among my American readers because they don't really follow the World Cup. But I'm glad that in Ireland, people find it interesting. You know, I'm sure people remember some elements of the story. It was at a time when Korea, after clawing its way up through the 20th century, you know, through civil war and, you know, the birth pangs of democracy and, you know, colonization. Many people consider Korea to be the Ireland of Asia, by the way, because it has a lot of parallels. It then suffered the Asian crisis in 1998, and its economy was suddenly in the tank, and it was receiving humiliating bailouts from the IMF and accusations of crony capitalism. But it had managed to place a successful bid for the World Cup when it was still riding high. But then its football team, the Reds, which are usually a regional power, were playing horribly. They lost to Kuwait in the Asia Cup of 2000. And so the Korean Football Association, the overlords of soccer, they took a gamble and they called Amsterdam, a fellow called Huss Hiddink, who probably your audience has some familiarity with. He's one of the most successful soccer coaches of all time. And he had a notoriety for putting together winning teams, not only in the Netherlands, but in Spain and elsewhere. And so they brought him to Korea, and many, when I explain this to Americans, they say, oh, he's the real Ted Lasso. You know, yeah. I don't know if Ted Lasso has come to Ireland yet.
But yes, he has. Yeah.
Show about a soccer player who arrives not really knowing anything about the place where he is going to coach, but in some ways brings exactly what they need. And that's sort of what happened in Korea in 2002. You had this very egalitarian Dutchman, you know, from the farming region in the far east of Netherlands, from a farming family, very down to earth, and coming to a society where the football tradition had been very hierarchical. There had been sort of unspoken traditions that the rookies will pass to the veteran at a crucial moment because someone with more seniority should make the kick, and that was a bit too predictable to opposing teams. And Hiddink in many, many ways sort of broke down those habits, in part by doing things that dialed down the South Korean identities and customs and norms and dialed up the sort of international football identities, because he was a strong believer that inside any individual, there are multiple tribes, there are multiple identities, and which one is driving the car depends on what situation you're in. So he held one of their first training camps, not in South Korea, but in the United Arab Emirates at an international soccer facility. And the Korean sports press was not invited. And the team was not allowed to use the honorific declensions of Korean on the field. And all of these sort of somewhat oblique strategies reduced the cues surrounding the team to behave, you know, to follow their Korean social customs on the field. And it allowed them to learn a more contemporary tactical system of total football, which was a faster and more competitive system.
Yeah. And maintaining, you know, all the time that they had their own distinct tribe, but using, as you say, another tribe's expertise and skill in the game, total immersion football, but actually bringing those two things together and creating an entirely new tribe and making that successful. Give us just an example of maybe how that tribal instinct, that tribal mobilization has been demonstrated for good in civic change, maybe throughout history or at a time in history in particular.
Sure. Just as Hiddink, you know, he might not put it this way, you know, he spoke a lot about players are adaptable, more adaptable than most coaches presume. But what I see in Hiddink is that he welcomed hybridity. You know, he didn't think culture was this precious thing that never changes. He thought it's something that takes a different shape in every generation. And this is a different way of thinking than what I would call classical multiculturalism, you know, the kind of multiculturalism that the Netherlands practiced in the early aughties, or that the UK practiced a decade or so ago. And in the civic policy realm, it's often called interculturalism as opposed to multiculturalism. And the idea is not that culture doesn't matter and we should ignore culture, but that we should welcome dialogue between the different cultures in our society. And we should be open to the fact that the culture will be changing, will be evolving. And a place that has adopted this way of thinking about culture is Catalonia. And I used to live in Barcelona, and I had the opportunity of spending some time with the Minister of Culture and Immigration, who was a proponent of this way of thinking. And, you know, he had a budget to sponsor cultural events. And so he would get proposals of all kinds. And some of them were, you know, celebrations of traditional Catalan customs, like eating callats or making human towers. And he would usually say, well, I think we have enough of that. That happens on its own. I don't need to fund that. And then people would come to him with proposals like, why don't we have a neighborhood soccer tournament where the Venezuelan neighborhood plays against the Italian neighborhood, which plays against the Catalan neighborhood, which plays against, you know. And he said, well, you know, I'm sure people would enjoy it, but it sort of reinforces divisions rather than showing people what they have in common. And so what he would fund would be things like He funded a dance festival that was illustrating the crossover between the tango and the Argentinian tango and the Spanish gypsy dance forms, and showing that these are all part of a larger tradition. He also did things like he wanted to incorporate the Pakistani community of Barcelona in the Carnival Festival, but the Carnival Festival was primarily oriented around eating butifarra, which is a pork sausage. And so he had his team do some reading about the past, and he found that in certain parts of Catalonia, they used to celebrate it with cheese. And so he kind of resurrected that aspect of the tradition, and that way more people could participate and eat and be part of the collective feast. So, you know, every group has a more complicated past. You know, history is, the past speaks with many voices.
Yeah.
Is a proverb that Nelson Mandela used to say. And we can mine the complexity of our collective past as a resource for flexibility in the future.
Yeah. And look, there's hundreds more examples of how tribalism is working in society and workplace and politics and communities right throughout the book. It's a fascinating book. And unfortunately, time is upon us. We did have lots more to talk about. So for now, we'll have to leave it there, Michael, I'm afraid. That was Michael Morris. He's the author of Tribal, How Cultural Instincts That Divide Us Can Help Bring Us Together. Michael, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Very thrilled to be here.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk with me, Mandy Johnson. Now, it's war games as the media becomes embroiled even further in the US presidential campaign. We look at the influence of one of the world's richest men on politics and the media. That's right after this short break. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item today, we're going to turn yet again to the stateside. And firstly, thank you all to everyone who got in contact with us last week about the explainer we did on the Electoral College. So, look, it's heating up and we're coming into the final days. And for the first time since 1988, the Washington Post, it says, will not be endorsing either candidate in Tuesday's US presidential election. And this wasn't, it seems, an editorial call by the paper staff. Instead, it was a decision made by Jeff Bezos, the owner and founder of Amazon. Bezos's decision has angered a lot of staff and a lot of readers of the Post. And one person who's been following the story is David Folkenflik, and he is the media correspondent for NPR News. And I'm delighted that David is joining me on the line now. David, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Oh, pleasure, Mandy. Thanks for having me on.
Now, before we get stuck into what happened, maybe just to give us a flavour about the Washington Post itself and how important it is in that kind of commentariat within the US and what it has done traditionally in the past vis-a-vis endorsements of particular candidates in a campaign.
Sure. So let's take stock. The Washington Post is one of sort of the great pillars of American democracy, American journalism, and in some ways democracy itself. It's privately owned by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, but it is, you know, known for really since the Pentagon Papers and Watergate, two epical moments in the struggle between the press and government of holding it accountable, even when it was taken, in the case of the Pentagon Papers, along with the New York Times, to the Supreme Court for publishing things that the Nixon administration had deemed national security secrets, and said, the government doesn't get to dictate to us in the way it does, for example, in the UK, whether or not we're allowed to publish something. There can be consequences after the fact, but not ahead of time. And similarly, Watergate, its coverage helped focus laser-like attention from prosecutors, investigators, and the United States Senate and House onto the allegations of wrongdoing of then-President Nixon and his administration that was sprawling. Hmm. In the Trump years, it embraced the slogan, democracy dies in darkness, and said that it would not be cowed in the face of a president who was willing to rhetorically attack the press and even do things to harm the press's business interests, as he did, Bezos and Amazon have alleged in court, to Amazon by giving a, you know, $10 billion Pentagon contract to Microsoft's computing services instead of the Post. I do want to say that in the American tradition, it's a bit different than in in Great Britain or in Australia, where there really is a very strong differential between the opinion side, the editorial pages on one side, and the news pages on the other. Mm. They are operated separately. It is not considered meddling or interference per se for an owner or a publisher chief executive to get involved. That's their prerogative. And at the same time, and we can talk about this in a minute, the way Jeff Bezos made his decision really undercut the faith people had that this was made for the reasons as presented. This is, as you suggest, the first time, and we took pains to look this up, but the first time since 1988 the Washington Post has not done so.
Mm. Yeah, and that separation of editorial and news is important, but the paper itself has spent a long time pointing out the deficiencies in Donald Trump's argument. And so it is surprising that at this juncture, at this most important time, when it is all on a knife edge, that this decision was made in the way that it was. What did Jeff Bezos say was his rationale for doing this at this time?
You know, look, he points to the idea that the press is the recipient of sort of all-time lows of trust from the American public, and says that, you know, we are a time of heightened partisanship, acrimony, divisiveness that is witnessable minute by minute right in front of me at the moment on social media, as well as our kind of cable news landscape. And that he wants the Post to get away from that. You know, the Post, one of its mottos and premieres, it calls itself an independent newspaper, which it assuredly is. But he's saying, you know, our news coverage is often viewed through the prism of ideology or partisanship by dint of who our editorials are backing or endorsing, and that much of the public doesn't understand the distinctions that make a lot of that hold a lot of meaning to us in journalism.
Mm.
So therefore, he wants to get out of this altogether. He hasn't said that he's getting out of the endorsement altogether for state and local elections in the District of Columbia, Maryland, Virginia, the areas where the preponderance of the Washington Post print subscribers are based. And so it's a little hard to understand why it matters on one scale and not another. It sounds like he wants to be out of the business of it. And that's his prerogative. But, you know, you do that when you name the British journalist Will Lewis, your publisher, early in the year, and it sounds different. You do that after a new president takes the oath of office and say, from here on out, we're not doing that. It's just a very different proposition to do it less than 2 weeks before a knife's edge election, where your own editorial page, this is not our assessment at NPR, this is the editorial page of the Washington Post, has declaratively said on numerous occasions that Donald Trump poses a threat to the American democratic experiment, and to say, well, folks, we don't really have a candidate to endorse because we want to be apart from all this. It feels as though there may be other elements in play.
Yeah, and we'll come to those in a second, because there's a lot of suspicion around the business engagements of this, and indeed even that fear of what might happen in the future. But let me just stick with the journalism thing, and just to be devil's advocate for a second on this. But does he have a point? If it's on a knife edge, and there is a newspaper that is so significant in the population for journalism, you know, for Pulitzer Prize winning journalism on this very issue of editorial opinion, that they step back and say, actually, we should not be involved in this one way or another.
I think that that is a perfectly legitimate position to take, as long as you're clear on it before your news organization's editorial page writers and editors have prepared for publication an editorial endorsing Trump's opponent.
Mm.
You know, yeah. Like they have the fact that he did this so close to the election. You know, if he had announced this, there would have been some objections within his news organization, but it's a it's his right.
It's the timing is everything, really, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, listen, I believe that the right thing to do is almost always the right thing to do, even if it's at a difficult moment. But he's saying it's the right thing to do at a moment where it's a different thing to do. What he's actually doing is withholding a specific endorsement of Vice President Harris as a figure in the election against Donald Trump. Mm. And listen, I want to be clear. I don't believe that major newspaper endorsements sway a whole ton of people. They allow bragging rights. They can be included in advertisements. All of that happens. But it's not a big, a huge influence on what people decide for candidates that they know well or know who are. That really matters much more on a local level. A local judge, a local county council figure. A lot of people just don't know who those candidates are. That's much more helpful. But in this case, it's a statement of principle and a purpose. The Washington Post has been a sort of key civic institution that stood up to Trump's authoritarian impulses and rhetoric. You know, they may have overreached. They may have at times gotten it wrong. But in good faith, they've said, listen, there are things worth sustaining about American democratic institutions, and the press is among them. Mm-hmm. And so there are people like David Remnick and even Bezos's former and legendary executive editor, Marty Baron, who saw Bezos as a stalwart ally during the Trump presidency, very supportive of and in no way interfered with the Post's initiatives to do accountability investigative reporting. You know, they're saying essentially you have to show a backbone and stand up for civic institutions, including the press itself, at a time when Trump is explicitly threatening retribution against news outlets that cross him or give him coverage he doesn't like or moderated debates in ways he didn't like, should he win election again. And so, you know, Marty Baron, who has praised Bezos and really won such accolades when the two of them were in tandem together, has called this decision cowardly and spineless. Mm. So yes, it's a perfectly legitimate decision to take to withhold a planned editorial days before an election that's knife's edge, so Trump could well get back into office when Bezos has the business interests he does, feels different to the people who don't rely on my assessment. This is the people who work for Bezos. Yes. And who have appreciated his patronage for recent years.
Yeah, and even Bezos' own argument, it's undermined entirely if he's trying to restore credibility in, you know, good press, good journalism. This is not the way to go about it. I think we all accept that. I listened to David Yelland, the former Murdoch editor, speaking a lot about fear and challenging fear from Donald Trump in a business sense, maybe, that might be what's motivating this. So maybe talk us through, we said a minute ago, this was all about timing. Maybe talk us through some of the other things that were happening around the time when Bezos made this decision, because there's a lot of people a little bit suspicious about some other meetings that were happening at the time.
So at NPR, we broke news of this on Friday morning. And the Post publicly acknowledged it in an essay by publisher and chief executive Will Lewis not long after. Some hours later that day, executives from Blue Origin, Bezos's space company, met with Trump to talk to him about what they do. What do they do? Well, they have among other things, they have a $3.4 billion contract with NASA. You know, the government agency that sends things into the air and conducts what we do in space. Bezos also, you know, Bezos, again, owns the newspaper individually, but he's still the executive chairman of Amazon, which he founded. He, you know, has other major concerns from the federal government. There was a cloud computing services contract up for bid that industry analysts were pretty convinced was going to go to Amazon from the Pentagon. Well, Trump said he was personally going to review that application because he was angry about the coverage of his administration in the Washington Post. And the Pentagon then awarded that contract, a $10 billion contract, to Microsoft instead. Amazon took it to court. It ended up being split up and it got a chunk of it. But that's billions of dollars that Trump has shown that Amazon at least alleged Trump essentially intervened to prevent him from getting to punish him. Similarly, Trump took actions against AT&T when it was seeking to acquire the parent company of CNN because he was angry at CNN, and his Justice Department went to court to try unsuccessfully to block it. He's now saying that he's going to do things to damage the business interests of ABC, CBS, and NBC. He's threatened to take away their broadcast licenses. That's not actually how it works in this country. Only local stations get licensed by the federal government to use public airwaves. But those three networks between them own 80 local television stations. So there are pressure points that he can exert and has promised to do so as part of a larger retribution against institutions that he sees as his enemies.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you wanted something to point to, you have it there as an example that Bezos himself has literally gone through. So, look, David, we did want to talk to you about the consequences of what happened and all the subscriptions that they lost and the many, many journalists and who worked for the paper before now have spoken about this. But sadly, time is upon us. I do want to congratulate you and your colleagues at NPR for breaking this story and for covering it so well and then for taking the time to be with us today. That was David Folk and Flick from NPR. He is the media correspondent there. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today.
You bet.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. My thanks to all of today's guests for their time and very, very valuable insights. The producer was John Fardy, Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on any of today's items, do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.